Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the forensic anthropologist Professor Sue Black. She leads a team of world renown with everyone from Murder Squad detectives to the United Nations knocking on the doors of her lab, looking for answers. Through her painstakingly detailed work, she is a teller of truths, a woman who uses her scientific skill to determine how people, often in the most terrifying and complex circumstances, have met their end. Her interest in the human body started with a brilliant biology teacher, and grisly though it seems, surely it must be the case that a part-time teenage job in a butcher shop inured her to the blood, bones and viscera that would become her stock in trade. Her work covers an impressive range from helping identify the human remains of the victims of the Asian tsunami to providing crucial information for the conviction of Scotland's largest paedophile ring. In Kosovo, she gathered evidence against Slobodan Milosevic for crimes against humanity, and she's recently been busy deciphering images of torture from Syria. Holding her nerve and keeping her focus then are essential. I say to myself, I did not cause this. I am not responsible for this. I could not have stopped this. I am here to find the answers. So welcome, Sue Black. Before we begin, I think it's worth just letting listeners know that because of what you do, some of what we're likely to discuss this morning is graphic and inevitably, I suppose, centres on the physical nature of death. I quoted you as saying there that you are there to find answers. You find them in the tiniest nooks and crannies of the human body, and that is bamboozling for those of us who know nothing really in detail about the work that you do. It could be about where somebody had tattoos on their body that aren't apparent from the body parts that you have. It could be to do with where their mother lived, for example. Things as detailed as that. How on earth do you do it?
Oh, it's great fun to be given the opportunity and the permission to open up the skin and look inside and see that every single one is different. And if every single one is different, that says, what can you use about the differences that allow you to say, that's who this individual may be? It's like being Taggart and it's like being Morse every single day, but using science and using anatomy.
In layman's terms, can you give me an example then? I just mentioned the tattoo, you know, that, that you might have body parts that don't show you the tattoo, and yet you managed to say this man, this woman had a tattoo on this part of their body.
Yeah.
How can that be the case?
Because it's all you have to understand is your anatomy. So when you have a tattoo, what you do with the needles and what you do with the dye is you place it between the two layers of skin. And the molecules of the ink are really large because you want them to stay there. You don't want the body to break them down. That's the whole point of a tattoo. It wants to be permanent. But some of those ink molecules are broken down. And you have in your body something called the lymphatic system, which is a system of little vessels that carry away all your tissue fluids and all the debris from your cells. And sitting up in various parts of your body, you've got like the sink trap in your shower that, you know, catches your hair and everything else. And because the molecules are so big, they sit trapped in the lymph nodes. So somebody who has a tattoo that is very identifiable, if we've still got those lymph nodes sitting up in your armpit, we will find the dyes of those tattoos. So I don't need the limb anymore. I can't tell you what the tattoo was, but I can tell you if there's blue dye and I can tell you if there's red dye, so that at least we get a clear indication that there were tattoos there.
So people looking for answers in life and death situations come to you. That must be a very stressful job. How do you wind down?
I don't, is the honest truth. Our youngest daughter, when she was 8, came to us one day and said, have we ever been on holiday? I thought, oh, that's really a bad thing to ask, isn't it? So both my husband and I felt really guilty on that. So we went on holiday to the south of Portugal, which was very nice, but it was very hot. And I'm a redhead and really don't cope terribly well with that. And I was so bored by day two that whilst everyone else was frolicking around in the pool, I'd written a textbook by the time I came home.
Professor Sue Black, tell me about your first disc this morning then. What are we going to hear and why have you chosen it?
We're going to hear You Jacobites by Name, which is by the Corries. And I was born in Inverness and I grew up in a very remote part of the West Coast, just on Lough Carron. And traditional music was still very, very strong. And when I was 11, we moved back to Inverness and it was right at the height of the Corries. And so having heard all of this traditional music and sung in the Gaelic mods, to then come to the dizzy metropolis that was Inverness and find that the Corries were, you know, hugely popular was just fantastic.
Ye Jacobites by name, Lendaneer, Lendaneer. Ye Jacobites by name, Lendaneer. Ye Jacobites by name, your faults I will proclaim, your doctrines I'm unblame. You will hear, you will hear, your doctrines I'm unblame. You will hear. What is right, what is wrong, by the law, by the law. What is right and what is wrong, by the law. What is right, what is wrong, the wicked and the strong, the short sword and the long, for to draw, for to draw, the short sword and the long, for to draw. Ye Jacobites by name, Lendaneer, Lendaneer. Ye Jacobites by name, Lendaneer.
That was the Corries and Ye Jacobites by name. So, Professor Sue Black, you've been running a department at the University of Dundee since, I think, 2003, is that right?
Yes.
You've opened this new state-of-the-art mortuary. I think that happened just last year. What are you laughing at?
It's just not the kind of thing that's normally said in a conversation.
Yes.
You opened a mortuary.
Well, I am talking to you.
Okay.
Yes.
Sorry.
So, and part of it then is devoted to teaching medics and to teaching dentists too, mm-hmm. I think, how better to do their jobs. And they operate on dissected bodies that
yes.
people have donated to science. And I mean, it's funny that you laugh at the word mortuary, because I don't laugh. I slightly sort of quail at the word mortuary. I mean, for most people, it would be really distressing and unnerving to walk into a mortuary. What did you feel initially the first time you walked into a mortuary?
It's very strange, because the first place that I walked into was a dissecting room, which is very different. And so in the dissecting room in Aberdeen University, what you had were about 40 bodies laid out, embalmed on what at the time were glass tables in what almost looked like a conservatory. So it was a Victorian parquet flooring
right.
with, you know, glass ceiling, glass walls. And you got the feeling of a clinical teaching room. But when I became a PhD student, I moved downstairs to my office. And so to get to my office every morning, you had to walk through the dissecting room. You had to walk through the area where they built the coffins. It was right above where the mortuary was, which was the floor below. And I shared my office with about 200 skeletons. So it's just normal life for us. It isn't unusual.
Let's have your next piece of music then. Tell me about this. We're going to listen to disc number two now.
Disc number two is Glenn Miller and In the Mood. My father was such an incredibly important personality in my life. He was a pianist and was the pianist for the local church. Now, when I mean local church, we're talking about maybe 8 to 10 people on a Sunday. And he always wanted to make sure that he was ready for church on Sunday. And I used to go up to the church with him on a Saturday night. And to limber up, he would play Glenn Miller's In the Mood. So you'd have this church in the middle of the West Coast, the middle of nowhere, Glenn Miller coming out of it on the church organ. And my job on the Sunday was that I had to stand at the front. And when it came to the last verse, it was my job to put my hand down on the pew in front of me. And that was his cue. So if I forgot to do that, we were in trouble, because it meant he kept playing and nobody was singing. But In the Mood for me is my father. He used to call it In the Nude, which he thought was terribly amusing.
Thank you.
was Glenn Miller and his band and In the Mood, or In the Nude, Professor the Sue Nude. Black, as your father used to call it. He was a cabinet maker to trade, isn't
he
that
was.
Right?
He was a cabinet maker, upholsterer, and what we call in Scotland a flitter. And a flitter is someone who moves you from one house to another.
And you said as you were introducing that last piece of music, he was such an important person in your life.
My father was not in the least little bit demonstrative. So he was a classic Scotsman of his age, that you knew he loved you, you knew he would do anything for you. I can't remember my father ever initiating a hug, never initiating holding my hand. But he was the product of his mother and his father. And I never knew his father, but my grandmother was singularly the most important person in my life.
And your grandmother called you her varsity girl.
She did. She came from Glen Elg. And for anyone who knows Glen Elg, it really is in the middle of nowhere. Mm. Tiny, tiny little village. And she was so incredibly worldly wise.
So my varsity girl, meaning my university girl. From a family, yes. So she had you pinned down as very smart from very early on.
Well, I don't know about being very smart, but she certainly had me pinned down for something.
And she had been a very heavy smoker, is that right?
She had, yes. Easily 40 a day.
And she died of lung disease.
She did.
When people have grandparents that make a big impression, it goes deep and it lasts a lifetime. What was her legacy to you?
When they opened up her chest and they realised there was absolutely nothing they could do, the cancer was so rife. What she said to me, and I remember being really upset about it, and she said to me, "Don't worry, I'm not going anywhere." Which, I just couldn't understand because I'd been told she was going to die. And she said, "Because for the rest of your life, I'm going to sit on your left shoulder. I'm not going anywhere. And if at any point in your life you want to ask me something, or you want to ask, is that the right thing to do? Just turn and ask me." And I find myself right the way throughout my life, sticking my head down to my left-hand side, thinking, I can't do that. I can't do that, because if there is a life beyond this, she's going to be waiting for me at the other end. And she's going to say, "I told you not to do that."
How old were you when she died?
15.
Oh, so young.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And so at that sort of age where you are very impressionable.
And how did you cope at the time?
Very well.
Did you?
Well, she didn't die.
She was there.
She stayed with me. Yeah.
Let's have your next piece of music then. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Baker Street by Gerry Rafferty.
And why have you chosen this?
Well, 1970s, Inverness, teenager, glorious hot summers. That was a really happy time that you probably didn't know at the time just how carefree you were. There was nothing in my life for me to worry about. School was going fine. I was thinking maybe university was going to go. I had a boyfriend that I liked really much. My parents were, not in any way on my case. Life was wonderful.
Winding your way down on Baker Street, light in your head and dead on your feet. Well, another crazy day. You'll drink the night away and forget about everything. This city desert makes you feel so cold. It's got so many people, but
that was Gerry Rafferty and Baker Street, and memories for you, Professor Sue Black, of those carefree early 70s days. Were you one of those high flyers in school? Did you love it? Was it a breeze?
I was very lucky. When I was in the West Coast, the school only had 12 pupils. And in primary seven, I moved to Inverness, and there were more people in primary seven than there had been in my entire school. And I found that such an incredible culture shock. I then moved into the secondary school, and at the time, Millburn Academy was just a zoo. It was awful. I hated every single moment I was in that school.
It's a good school now, and it does
it's
very well now.
It's one of the
now,
best schools in Inverness now. But at the time, it was a very challenging school.
And as a teenager working in a butcher's shop, I mean, the back shop in a butcher's is a pretty, it's a pretty extreme place. How did you find it?
Well, my friend Susan got a job in the farm shop. And I thought, what a good idea. You can work and earn money. So can I have a job too? And I lasted one Saturday in the vegetable shop because I really was not the kind of person to sell carrots and cauliflowers. So the other option was there was a butcher shop. And I'm, can I work there? And that was it. And I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
What did you like about it?
I liked the order. I liked that there was a specific way around bones that you would remove muscle to produce a particular final appearance. I liked the fact that I could understand where on an animal every single bit had come from. And it was always cold in a butcher shop. And we used to love it when the vans came up from the slaughterhouse, especially if it was on a day when you had liver on board, because the livers always came in fresh. So if you put your hands into the liver boxes, they were warm. And so that was great.
How aware are you that you're very unusual?
I don't think so at all. I think it's perfectly normal, isn't it?
Well, you know fine well it's not. And you have that slightly challenging look in your eye when you're talking about it. You're daring me to be disgusted by you.
But it isn't. It's natural. It's a butcher shop, you know.
Tell me about Dr. Fraser then, this inspirational biology teacher.
Well, after Millburn, I was so determined to get out that you had to sit exams. And if you sat exams, then you got to go to the academy. And that was Inverness Royal Academy. And I met Dr. Fraser in biology. And he was just such a lovely man. And he made everything so completely understandable. And we decided that I needed some experience of working. And he sent me to Rigmore Hospital to get some work experience as a lab technician. And I came back and I said, that's what I'm going to be. I'm going to be a laboratory technician. And I can remember being so shocked because he swore at me and he said, don't be so blooming stupid. You're going to university. And I thought, that's what my grandmother had said. Now, if that's the case, then maybe I ought to go. And first of all, I applied and didn't tell my parents I was applying because I didn't believe I'd actually get in. And then when I got the letter that said I'd been accepted, I lied and I told my parents I had a full grant because at the age of 17, I had decided I knew better, that they couldn't afford to support me. And so I took 3 or 4 different jobs while I was a student just to make sure I made ends meet.
It's time for some more music then, Professor Sue Black. We're on your fourth track of the day. Tell me a little bit about this.
And now we're going to get sloppy.
Go on then.
So this is Romeo and Juliet and this is Dire Straits. Tom and I went to university together from Inverness. Tom is my husband. And so I've known him since I was 17 years of age. He is my best friend and this was one of his tracks.
Juliet says, hey, it's Romeo. He nearly gave me a heart attack. He's underneath the window. She's singing, Eli, my boyfriend's back. You shouldn't come around here singing up at people like that. Anyway, what you gonna do about it? Juliet, the dice was loaded from the start. And I bet any you explode.
Dire Straits and Romeo and Juliet, and you chose that, Professor Sue Black, for your husband, Tom, who you met when you were 17. Now, you were married once before, and it wasn't Tom that you were married to.
No,
you got married quite early and had a daughter in your early 20s.
That's right.
Yes, yeah. And so that period when you were just coming out of university, you'd graduated, you were married and you were pregnant, did you have an idea of what you were going to do work-wise? Did you have a career path, as our students these days are so encouraged to do?
Not really, no. What I was very lucky with was that I had a very dear friend, Louise Shaw, in London, and she informed me that there was a teaching job going at St Thomas's Hospital. And so I was just out of my PhD, and she said, come and interview. And the very last question asked of me was, if you can go into the dissecting room this afternoon, could you teach the brachial plexus? To which I said, yes, of course. And by being able to answer that, the job was mine. So I really went into the academic side by accident.
Can you remember the very first time that you dissected a human body?
Yes, because it was in my third year in university. And so it was in the dissecting room in Aberdeen. And that first cut that you make with a sharp scalpel through skin is something that you can never repeat twice because it is only a one-time event. And our students today, you can see their nervousness. And no matter how much you tell them, you're nervous now, in 10 minutes you will forget to be afraid. And it's wonderful to watch because when you go into the dissecting room, there is this heightened fear and anticipation. And then they forget about it because once you're below the skin, what lies underneath there is just amazing. And you forget to be scared.
And of course, we are hot-wired to be scared. But after you had done it, would it be too much to say that it was a sort of life-changing experience?
Oh, unquestionably. I think, you know, once you've gone into the human body and you have that responsibility, because this person who's in front of you, when they were alive, they made a conscious decision that they wanted to leave their body so that somebody could learn. And that's a gift that nobody will ever give you again. It's such an honour. So our very first lecture before they go into the dissecting room says, the man or the woman that you are going to dissect was alive a year ago, a year and a half ago. They have sons, they have daughters. Those people have sat in my office and had a cup of coffee with me. These people are there because they want to be there. And the only request they're asking of our students is, I'm giving you this, what I'm leaving behind. All I'm asking you to do is learn.
What do you mean they've sat in your office and had a cup of coffee?
So somebody who wants to bequeath their body may say, I want to come in and talk to you. I want to hear what you're going to do. And they'll come in and we'll make a cup of coffee and they will tell me about their life and they will tell me about their grandchildren and they'll tell me about everything that's wrong with them. And the relationship that we set with these people who are giving us that gift is so incredibly personal that it's our job when they're in our dissecting room to look after them. And in May, we have a funeral service where the family and friends come along and we get to meet them and the students get to meet. These are the families of the people who gave us that gift.
Time for some more music, Sue Black. Tell me about this one then.
This is Winter by Love and Money, and I suspect this isn't a band that's terribly well known outside, down south of Hadrian's Wall. And when I was writing a textbook with my dear friend Louis Shore, it took us nearly 10 years to write it, we're not very quick. This was me in my attic, in my ivory tower, being a totally selfish academic, writing a textbook, and this would blare out. So for me, this is a really pivotal point in my academic career. It was a textbook that nobody else had written.
And the subject was juvenile.
And the subject was juvenile osteology, so the development of the child skeleton, because identification of children is something that we have an expertise in.
I wish this dream would end, so another could begin. Lord, let me walk on the beach again. When love turns to dust, these are splinters of your trust, forgiven. Shine on, shine on, in the beauty of the storm I weather.
That was Love and Money and Winter. So, Professor Sue Black, forensic anthropology, just to be clear, is where you are studying human remains to establish not just the identity of somebody, but also often the circumstances of their death. And it can be as detailed as, I mean, I've heard about cases where even things like plant spores being discovered on and about a person can give a clue as to where their body might have been buried before, or somebody's hair can tell you which countries they've travelled to or spent time in, really extraordinary bits of information like that. Can you think of a case, just to give people an example, that has particularly surprised or delighted or been significant for you in your work?
The significance comes when you get a name. And so for us, every case is a challenge. When we don't succeed and we don't get a name for that person, then that is our worst possible outcome, because we just want to be able to put that full stop. And some of the work that we did in Kosovo was particularly challenging, because that was about coming to an identification of individuals where there was very little background information. So, for example, a particular case where a family were involved and a rocket-propelled grenade took out the tractor and the trailer that they were coming down to in the village. And Dad was snipered in the leg, so he managed to get away, but everybody who was on that trailer lost their lives. And on that trailer was his wife, her sister, their mother, and their six children. And the six children ranged from a newborn baby up to two 14-year-old boys. And under cover of darkness, he came back and he buried everything he could find of his family. So for somebody to go through something like that is almost unimaginable. We come along about a year later with the War Crimes Tribunal and say, we want to exhume this grave because we think this is evidence against Milosevic. And I think, you know, for most families, it would be a, no, I've buried them, yeah, you know, leave them. But he was the most amazing man, because what he said was, I'm really worried that God can't find all of my family because they're all in one place. And each one of them needs to have a grave so that God can find them. And so we we exhumed the hole in the ground and we sent everybody else away in the mortuary that day, and we laid out 11 sheets on the floor and we said, we're going to have to try and find a bit of everybody because this man needs to have a bit of all of his family back. So his wife was easy to identify, the sister was easy to identify, the mother was easy to identify, and all of the children were, until we got to the two twin 14-year-old boys. Everything that we went through on that body, we couldn't tell the boys apart. And one of the bodies was wearing a Mickey Mouse vest. And we said to the police officer, go and talk to Dad and ask Dad if any of his children wore a Mickey Mouse vest. And Dad came back and went, oh, yes, that twin boy, he was absolutely obsessed with Disney and with Mickey Mouse. And something that was so totally not related to our science, yes, but so personal, crossed that boundary to allow us to say with some confidence, I can now separate probably what are your two 14-year-old boys. And we handed all of the bodies back to him. And at the end of that, he came back to the team and he thanked every single member of the team for what they'd done. And we were just so uncomfortable and so embarrassed that somebody would thank us for what we'd had to do. But for him, it meant everything, absolutely everything.
It's time for some more music then, Professor Sue Black. What are we going to hear now?
We're going to go very Scottish again. This is the Lathallan Pipe Band. Lathallan is a school, and my girls were in the pipe band. And they used to play Highland Cathedral, and it also became one of my father's really favourite pieces.
That was your daughters, Professor Sue Black, in the Lathallan Pipe Band, and they were playing Highland Cathedral. We've heard you talk today about the really tragic and gruesome things that humanity is capable of. I'm wondering, as you're down on your hands and knees collecting the bones or examining them in the lab, what occurs to you about the capability and the state of humanity? What thoughts do you have?
I think much of the time we don't allow ourselves to have those thoughts. Some of the things that we saw in Kosovo, some of the things that we've seen in relation to the violence that a person can put, you know, can meter out onto somebody else. If you spent your time dwelling on those, I wonder just how reliable and how unbiased we could remain as scientists.
And do you have a decompression ritual? I mean, is there a set of things that you will do when you come home, when you have been dealing with those particularly horrendous cases, that you think, this will just cleanse me?
I try not to ever take it home. You need it to stay within the people who are exposed to it. So if we have a case, we will sit around the table and we will talk it out. And most of the time, by the end of that, we're absolutely fine. We're able to cope. We can move on to the next one.
Tell me about your next piece of music. What are we going to hear? We're on your seventh.
Yeah, we're going to hear Cher with If I Could Turn Back Time. And the reason for it being is that some of the work that we do, and certainly within Kosovo, was so intense that you needed downtime. You needed time that says we can afford to party a bit. And so we were invited to a party just on the other side of the airport in Kosovo. And to get there, we had to cross Russian lines. So we all hid in the back of an ambulance. And it was the Marines that were having a party. And
yes, and that's not canasta and a cup of warm cocoa.
No, absolutely not. So there was a conga line at one point, rather. Can I say that we were not involved, only the Marines. There's not a lot of clothing involved. And the senior officer came and, you know, apologised to us. I'm terribly sorry, but, you know, we have these Marines doing a naked conga, which for us was no problem. I've dissected better, so it's fine. And so we were not at all offended, but this was party time Kosovo, which was downtime.
Cher and If I Could Turn Back Time. So the spiritual side of Professor Sue Black, I mean, you've spoken not just about your, you know, your dad playing the organ in the church and you going on a Saturday to help him rehearse and how close you were to him, but also your grandmother, you know, saying, I'll be on your shoulder, I'll be there with you. You know, do you believe in a spiritual life, or do you think that once we're dead and buried and decomposed, that's it?
I have been fortunate enough to be at the moment of death with both my mother-in-law and with my father, and to be there to hold their hand when they take that last breath. And the shift that happens in that last breath from being the person that you know to there being something gone, missing, is like a light going out. I have never been spooked by the dead. I've spent my life with the dead. They don't hold any fear for me at all. When you leave that shell, you've gone. I have no idea what's on the other side. I believe in Christian values, but I'm not a religious believer.
Let's have your final piece of music, Professor Sue Black. Tell me what we're going to hear.
This is my children. I felt very strongly with all of my girls, I have three girls, that there was a prayer that my mother used to make us say every night, now I lay me down to sleep. And in it, it says, if I shouldn't wake in the morning. And my rationale for my kids was that should they not wake in the morning, the last thing they should hear before they go to sleep is their mother singing. And so I sang in the Gaelic mods and did all sorts of things. And
oh, you
every
have to be
night,
very good to do that.
Yeah, no, you don't.
Yes,
no, there's some
do.
Really bad singing in
That's
the Gaelic
not
mods.
True.
Trust me. Oh, yes, there is. There was when I did it. And so for my girls, every night as they went to sleep, it was my job to sing to them. And I had a number of them, including the Corries, but this one, which is a Nancy Griffith song, which is called Turnaround.
That's Nancy Griffith and Turn Around. I'm going to cast you away now and give you the books to take with you, Sue Black. You will get the complete works of Shakespeare, you'll get the Bible, and you get to take a book of your own. What are you going to take?
It can only be Grey's Anatomy, and it can only be the 36th edition.
Right, that's yours then. And a luxury too.
I'm a redhead. I suspect it's going to be hot. I just need a very, very big hat.
Ah, yes, indeed.
Very
a beautiful,
big hat.
A beautiful big sun hat,
yeah.
Is yours then. And if you could just save one of these discs, which one would it be?
It would be Highland Cathedral, yeah.
With your girls in the
With
band.
My girls, Just the capabilities of children are just amazing.
Professor Sublack, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.